The small group of Jewish prisoners inside the camp's tailor shop exchanged fearful glances as the sound of hooves grew louder outside. One of them quickly peeked out one of the hut's small windows. "He's arrived," he muttered. "Get ready." A few seconds later, and the hut door opened, and in stepped SS-Untersturmführer Johann Niemann, the 30-year-old deputy commandant of the Sobibor extermination camp. Outside, another prisoner held the bridle of Niemann's chestnut horse that he used to ride imperiously around the camp. Niemann tucked his riding crop under one armpit and began to slowly remove his gloves, his hard eyes moving around the room and settling momentarily on each of the Jewish faces before him. The prisoners took in Niemann's uniform and shuddered. A devil walked among them, the SS Death's Head badge grinning at them from Niemann's cap band and from his right collar patch. As a concentration camp officer in the notorious SS Totenkopfverbande, the SSTV, Niemann did not wear the twin lightning flash runes of the Waffen-SS on his collar. His rank was indicated by three silver pips arranged in a diagonal line on his left collar patch and army-style silver shoulder straps. The prisoners glanced at his waist, where his black belt with its silver SS buckles supported a leather holster. Inside sat Niemann's Luger pistol, ready for instant use against any problem prisoners. One of the tailors brought out an unfinished officer's uniform, ready for Niemann to try on. After removing his belt and tunic, the prisoners were helping him into the new jacket when Niemann sensed movement behind him. He turned his head to one side and managed to mutter, "Was?" before Soviet prisoner of war Alexander Shubayev buried a homemade hatchet in his skull. Niemann didn't scream, just grunted at the impact, which killed him instantly. He collapsed onto the hut's wooden floor, dark rivulets of blood running across its dusty surface from the gaping wound in his head. One prisoner picked up Niemann's heavy gun belt and drew the Luger from its holster. It felt solid and cold in his grasp. He looked at his comrades and nodded slowly. The Sobibor revolt had commenced. Beginning in 1940, the Nazis had established 16 labor camps in the Lublin region near the village of Sobibor. It was intended that the Jews sent to these camps would work as agricultural laborers under German colonial overseers. Over 95,000 Jews expelled from Warsaw and Vienna were shipped in for this task and paid for their labor. They were housed in a network of sub-camps based on the concentration camp at Kreuzhof. Sobibor camp was constructed by Hauptsturmführer Richard Thomalla between March and April 1942, using Jewish Sonderkommando labor after German policy towards the Jews had dramatically changed. The location, marshy woodland with a sparse population, was chosen because it was close to the rail line that ran between Chelm and Vlodava, connecting the general government, as the German-occupied territory of Poland was now called, with Reichskommissariat Ukraine. The garrison would consist of a German commandant, initially Obersturmführer Franz Stangl, 29 SS non-commissioned officers, and between 90 and 120 Ukrainian SS auxiliaries, known as Travnikis, after the camp where they were trained. At the end of August 1942, a new commandant was appointed after Stangl was moved to take command at Treblinka. He was SS Hauptsturmführer Franz Reichsleitner. An Austrian, Reichsleitner had been born in 1906 and was another Aktion T4 veteran. At the Hartheim Institute, Reichsleitner had worked alongside Stangl under the command of Christian Wirth. The prisoners at Sobibor regarded Reichsleitner as an austere figure who was always immaculately turned out in his uniform and always wore gloves. He had very little to do with the Jews, relying on his trusted second-in-command, Niemann, and a coterie of efficient SSTV sergeants and corporals. But it was obvious that Reichsleitner was feared and respected by the other SS. Sobibor was small compared with Auschwitz or Dachau, consisting of three camps surrounded by a barbed wire fence into which tree branches had been woven. Trees had also been planted around the camp's perimeter to further shield it from public view. Camp 1, under the command of SS-Oberscharführer Karl Frenzel, consisted of the main administration officers, housing for the German SS and Travniki auxiliaries, and barracks for a large detachment of Jewish Sonderkommandos. Here also was the prisoner's kitchen. 32-year-old Frenzel had been active with the Nazis since 1930, when he had enlisted in the SA, the Stormtroopers. When war broke out in 1939, Frenzel had been drafted into the Reich Labour Service, but soon after released to help take care of his five children. Desperate to take part in the war effort, Frenzel volunteered through his SA connections, was recruited into the SSTV, and was assigned to the highly secret Aktion T4. The T4 euthanasia program, that was partly based at Schloss Hartheim in Austria, was the bloody prelude to the industrialized murders that were to follow in places like Treblinka and Sobibor. The mentally retarded and physically disabled were murdered on the recommendations of doctors as the Nazis attempted to remove all what they called defectives from their population. Over 70,000 patients were to die during the course of the program, which continued in operation until just after the war ended in 1945. Told that the killings were the responsibility of doctors, Frenzel, Stangl, Reichsleitner, and the other SSTV men had set aside their moral reservations and done their duty, as they conceived of it. Frenzel's primary job was removing bodies from the small gas chambers, wrenching out any gold teeth, and then burning the bodies in the crematoria. On the 20th of April 1942, Frenzel was assigned to Sobibor, where he was widely detested and feared by the prisoners, and was known for using his whip on them frequently. In one notorious incident in spring 1943, two Jews from Chelm were caught trying to escape from Sobibor. Frenzel decided, in consultation with the other SS senior NCOs, that an example should be made. At roll call, every 10th Jew was taken out of the line to be shot, 20 being murdered in this way. Following this escape attempt, a minefield was laid around the outside of the camp's perimeter as a further deterrent. Camp 2, or the Vorlager, consisted of the railway platform, where evacuation trains were offloaded, a ramp, the undressing barracks, and warehouses, where 400 of the Jewish Sonderkommandos worked. They sorted and stored property confiscated from Jews who arrived by train at the camp platform. There was also a building where the newly arrived Jews had their heads shaved and their valuables taken from them before they proceeded into Camp 3 and the gas chambers. Camp 3 contained a further Sonderkommando unit's barracks, these men tasked with the open-air cremation of the bodies of the dead, and the disposal of these bones and ashes in large pits. The evacuation trains that brought the Jews to Sobibor consisted of between 40 and 60 freight cars. The platform at Camp 2 was large enough to permit the unloading of 20 cars at a time. On arrival, the SS told the Jews that the facility was a transit camp, where they would be disinfected for lice and processed through to working parties in labour camps elsewhere. "I helped Jews out of the trains with all their baggage," said Sonderkommando Philip Bialowitz. "My heart was bleeding knowing that in half an hour they would all be reduced to ashes. I couldn't tell them. I wasn't allowed to speak. Even if I told them, they wouldn't believe they were going to die." Fresh arrivals were met by SS NCOs, whose welcome speech was designed to make the Jews cooperate in their own destruction. "The Jews of Warsaw, your attention," one of the SS would shout along the length of the platform. "You are in a transit camp, from which you will be sent to a labour camp. As a safeguard against epidemics, you must immediately hand over your clothing and parcels for disinfection. Gold, silver, foreign currency, and jewellery must be placed with the cashier in exchange for a receipt. These will be returned to you at a later time upon presentation of the receipt. For bodily washing before continuing with the journey, all arrivals must attend the bathhouse." Some of the new arrivals would be hived off into the ranks of the Sonderkommandos to replace those who had died from disease, exhaustion, or been murdered. In this way, tens of thousands of people arrived at the railway platform in front of the camp with no idea of what awaited them. The main deportations to Sobibor were made between May 1942 and autumn 1943. The Jews came primarily from the ghettos of the General Government, with others from the Soviet Union, Germany, Austria, Slovakia, Bohemia and Moravia, the Netherlands and France. Altogether, upwards of 170,000 people entered Sobibor. The events that led to a Sonderkommando rising at Sobibor had their roots elsewhere. Rumours arrived in Sobibor that most of the 600 Sonderkommando workers would soon become surplus to requirements and that the Germans planned to kill them. The reason for this was that another Aktion Reinhard death camp at Belzec had been closed and dismantled, the Germans shooting the remaining Sonderkommandos. The Sonderkommandos realized that the same thing would probably happen at Sobibor, as the number of evacuation transports had noticeably slowed. The Jews needed a plan of action to save themselves. "We started organizing and talking, and it gave us something to live for again," said Esther Raab, a female prisoner. "The idea that maybe we'll be able to take revenge for all those who can't." The leader of the Jews in Sobibor was Leon Feldhendler, the 33-year-old son of a Polish rabbi. He had been the head of the Judenrat, or the Nazi-enforced Jewish council, in his home village of Zolkivka in Lublin. With a hard core of conspirators, Feldhendler considered several possible avenues of escape. The initial plan was to poison the SS and seize their weapons. But vigilant SS guards discovered a secret batch of poison, and five Jews were shot in retaliation. Another plan was to set fire to the camp and try to escape during the subsequent confusion. But the mining of the camp perimeter by army engineers following the attempted escape of two Jews made such a plan extremely risky. The plan was eventually rejected as impractical. What Feldhendler and his fellow plotters lacked was organizational ability, and who better to possess those skills than soldiers? The answer to Feldhendler's problems was the arrival at Sobibor on the 23rd of September 1943 of a man called Sasha. Lieutenant Quartermaster Class II Alexander, or Sasha, Pechersky was a 34-year-old Jewish Red Army officer who had been captured in the Battle for Moscow in 1941. The son of a lawyer, Sasha was born in Ukraine, gained a degree in music and literature in Rostov, and was working as an accountant and manager of a small music school when he was conscripted into the Red Army as a junior lieutenant on the 22nd of June 1941, the day the Germans launched Operation Barbarossa. Promoted to lieutenant in September, Sasha was captured in October, the city of Vyazna. He suffered 7 months of typhus before escaping with four other prisoners of war in May 1942. Recaptured the very same day, Sasha was sent to a penal camp in Belorussia, and then to another harsh camp near Minsk. During the routine medical examination, it was revealed that he was circumcised, and Sasha immediately admitted to being a Jew. On the 20th of August 1942, he was separated from non-Jewish prisoners of war and sent to an Arbeitslager, or work camp, in Minsk. On the 18th of September 1943, 2,000 Minsk Jews, including 100 Jewish Red Army soldiers, were herded onto a cattle train and sent to Sobibor, arriving on the 23rd of September. Sasha was among 80 Jews selected to join the Sonderkommando in Camp 2. The sudden and unexpected arrival of prisoners who were trained soldiers provided the conspirators with a considerable morale boost. Perhaps these Soviets could help. Sasha also made an impression on the SS quite early on. He was clearly a man who commanded respect among his peers, and also a proud military officer and no mere slave. 3 days after his arrival, Sasha was outside the camp on a working party that was chopping up tree stumps. In command of the party, which was guarded by a detachment of SS Travnikis, was SS Oberscharführer Frenzel. Impatient at the exhausted manner in which the Jews were tending to their tasks, Frenzel had decided to punish certain workers with 25 lashes from his whip. Frenzel noticed that Sasha had stopped work during one of these punishments. "Russian soldier," shouted Frenzel, "you don't like the way I punish this fool? I give you exactly 5 minutes to split this stump." Frenzel kicked a large tree stump with the toe of his black jackboot. "If you make it, you get a pack of cigarettes. If you miss by as much as 1 second, you get 25 lashes," said Frenzel, a cruel smile creasing his face. Sasha attacked the stump with his axe like a madman, Frenzel timing him with his watch. He finished in 4.5 minutes. Frenzel, his face a mask of anger, proffered a pack of cigarettes. "Thanks, I don't smoke," said Sasha. Frenzel, muttering under his breath, stalked off while the other prisoners continued chopping, astonishment drawn across their sweaty faces. They were even more surprised when Frenzel returned with a lump of bread and some margarine and offered them to Sasha. The big red army officer shook his head slowly and said, "Thank you. The rations we are getting satisfy me fully." Frenzel's face turned beetroot red, his fist tightening around his whip handle. He stared at Sasha for a moment, clearly debating in his mind what he should do, while Sasha ignored him and returned to chopping wood. Frenzel once again stalked off. The incident deeply impressed the other members of the working party, and that night the proud defiance of the Soviet officer was the talk of the Sonderkommando barracks in Camp 1. It was obvious that the resistance organization desperately needed someone like Sasha, and Feldhendler reached out to him on the 29th of September. He hoped that Sasha might be able to contact the partisans, many of whom were escaped Soviet POWs, to enlist their aid in liberating the Sobibor Jews. But Sasha was unequivocal in his response. "The partisans have their own tasks," he replied to Feldhendler, "and no one can do our work for us." The meaning was clear. If the Jews wanted out of Sobibor, they would have to do all the work themselves. Some of Sasha's fellow Soviet prisoners were already exploring an escape from the camp, but only for themselves. They were reluctant to let untrained and disorderly foreign civilians join them. But Feldhendler countered that if the Soviet POWs managed to escape, the SS would retaliate against the innocent Jewish civilians left behind in the camp. He managed to convince Sasha that any escape should include everybody. It was decided that it would be better from a security standpoint if the Germans did not see Sasha and Feldhendler constantly meeting. Instead, a young Jew named Shlomo Leitman would act as a go-between for the two leaders. Sasha and his men carefully gathered intelligence on the layout of the camp, the number of guards, their personalities, routines, and armament, as well as the all-important perimeter defences. In this, the civilian Jewish members of the Sonderkommando proved invaluable, having been imprisoned in Sobibor for much longer than the Soviets. The first plan proposed by Sasha was a tunnel. Digging began in early October 1943 beneath the carpenters' workshops in Camp 2. On the 7th of October, Sasha became very concerned. It was clear that there weren't enough hours of darkness for all of the camp's prisoners to successfully pass through the long tunnel to freedom, and he knew that the non-military backgrounds of the civilian workers would probably lead to arguments and fights breaking out amongst those waiting to go. Before Sasha was forced to call off the tunnel break, the diggings were destroyed by 2 days of very heavy rain on the 8th and 9th of October. It was back to the drawing board. The second plan was a much more dangerous proposition, a revolt. This would involve attacking and overpowering the guards and seizing the camp. Though this appeared to be a tall order, Sasha believed that the key to the plan's success was to remove the German brain from the larger SS body. That was, to kill the small number of German SSTV officers and NCOs who administered the camp. It was the same conclusion that was reached by the desperate resistors at Treblinka II. Sasha believed that if the prisoners succeeded, the remaining Ukrainian SS guards would be confused and possibly open to negotiations. If all else failed, the prisoners could fight them with weapons captured off the dead guards, or they could try to storm and capture the camp's armory. It was known that the Travnikis were not completely trusted by the regular SS and only issued with limited ammunition for their weapons. The gravity of what the prisoners were planning to do was not lost on any of them for a second. "We had no dreams of liberation," said Thomas Toivy Blatt. "We hoped merely to destroy the camp and to die from bullets rather than from gas. We would not make it easy for the Germans." The Travnikis, who provided the bulk of the guards in the camp, were armed with 5-shot bolt-action rifles. The guard towers also contained MG-42 machine guns, extremely rapid firing, and highly effective belt-fed weapons. The SSTV men were routinely armed with Luger or Walter P-38 semi-automatic pistols, and had access to MP-40 machine pistols. In response, Sasha asked the prisoners to begin manufacturing large knives and small hatchets. These would be used to dispose of as many of the German SS NCOs as possible in a series of carefully planned ambushes. The Travnikis were even more strongly despised than the Germans. "We were terrified of the Ukrainian guards at Sobibor," said Blatt. "They were worse than the Germans. They mistreated us. They shot the old and the sick new arrivals who couldn't walk anymore. And they were the ones who drove the naked people into the gas chambers with their bayonets." Blatt's job involved cleaning SS boots. "They would come back with splashes of blood on their boots. I often had to work a few feet away. If the Jews refused to go on, they hit them and fired shots. I can still remember their shout of "Ides wieder," which means "come here." Camp Commandant Hauptsturmführer Reichsleitner left on leave shortly before the revolt. The 12th of October, the hated and feared senior SSTV NCO in the camp, Oberscharführer Gustav Wagner, also departed on leave. Wagner was known to be exceptionally cunning and unrelenting in his efforts to uncover subversive activity among the Sonderkommandos. "Wagner's departure gave us a tremendous morale boost," said conspirator Thomas Toivy Blatt. "While cruel, he was also very intelligent. Always on the go, he could suddenly show up in the most unexpected places. Always suspicious and snooping, he was difficult to fool. Besides, his colossal stature and strength would make it very difficult for us to overcome him with our primitive weapons." With Reichsleitner and his chief guard dog Wagner gone, Sasha ordered that the final revolt plan be ready by the end of the 12th of October. The Soviet POWs were dispatched singly to each of the huts, where an ambush killing was to be perpetrated in order to stiffen the resolve of the resistors and to do the actual killing if necessary. Each hut had organized a combat team, consisting of about 3 men, with their knives and hatchets carefully concealed. The targeted German officers and NCOs would be lured singly into the huts and then dispatched. Lures included appointments for uniform or boot fittings, or to peruse expensive coats taken from recent transports. The planning took into consideration the German brashness and power-hungry mistreatment of the seemingly subdued Jews, said Blatt. Their consistent and systematic daily routine, their unfaltering punctuality, and their greed. The targets were carefully selected. The most important was Deputy Commandant Untersturmführer Johann Niemann. In the absence on leave of Reichsleitner, Niemann was acting commandant of the camp. Born in 1913, Niemann had joined the Nazi Party in 1931 and the SS in 1934. He had served at another Aktion Reinhard camp, Belzec. Transferred to Sobibor, Niemann was commissioned as an officer after Heinrich Himmler's visit to the camp on the 12th of February 1943. According to Karl Frenzel, Niemann was a brutal officer. "A Polish capo, a Jewish worker appointed to oversee other Jews, told me that some Dutch Jews were organizing an escape, so I relayed it to Deputy Commandant Niemann. He ordered the 72 Jews to be executed. The Jews were also aided by the fact that almost a dozen SS NCOs were away from camp on leave when the revolt was launched." The method for killing the SS was to be as quiet as possible. They were to be axed in the skull or stabbed to death. Their bodies quickly hidden. X Day, the day the revolt would be launched, was set for the 13th of October. But in the morning, Sasha and the rest of the plotters were disconcerted by the sudden arrival in the camp of a company of SS men. There was much confusion among the prisoners, who initially feared that their plot had been discovered and the extra manpower brought in to deal with them. But instead, the SS piled out of their trucks and started eating and drinking with the Sobibor SSTV men in the main canteen. As the extra SS were still in the camp at lunchtime, Sasha decided to postpone the revolt until the following day. Later in the afternoon, the visiting SS company packed up and drove away. On the 14th of October, everyone was ready. It was now or never. At noon, each battle team commander secretly met with Sasha for final instructions. There was one nasty moment when Frenzel marched into the carpentry shop and noticed that one of the prisoners was dressed in his best clothing. The prisoners had gathered their few possessions ready for the revolt. Unlike Wagner, who would undoubtedly have become suspicious, Frenzel instead sarcastically asked the man whether he was off to a wedding. At 2 p.m., Unterscharführer Walter Hochberg, who was not on the target list to be killed, suddenly entered Camp 1 armed with an MP-40 machine pistol. This was unusual, as the SSTV men rarely carried such firepower. Hochberg took away 4 prisoners. Sascha discovered that Hochberg was so armed because he hadn't had with him a Ukrainian Travniki as backup, because all of those recently on leave. By 4 p.m., the battle teams were ready and in position. The first to die was Acting Commandant Niemann. Once he was dead, his body was quickly dragged into a hiding place and the blood cleaned up. The officer's loaded Luger pistol was added to the resistors' meager stash of weapons. Another prisoner led Niemann's horse back to the camp stables to complete the illusion of normality. Now would begin the grim task of murdering the SS and launching the breakout.